the short-term risk is that we've already got thousands of pounds and more than that, many, many tons of engineered nanoparticles that are out there in the environment. They're used in coatings. They're used on car bumpers. You know, they're being used in industry right now.
I understand that you are a cheerleader, and you're going to come back to the positive side every time you can do it. But I'm really wanting to hold you online here.
Oh, no, I'm agreeing with you here, Art. I'm just saying the problem is we have these nanoparticles out there in the environment, but we have not determined their medical impacts. And that's why, for example, the EPA put a huge amount of $9 million, yippee-doo, into examining the potential medical impacts. Well, it was clear from the conference that I attended last year at the invitation of the Institute of Medicine at the Academy of Sciences that we are way behind on examining the short-term medical risks that are posed by nanoparticles, engineered nanoparticles.
Well, Douglas, isn't the EPA going to get into the same kind of trouble as the patent office?
Well, that's a good question. At the moment, it's quite clear that, as is normal with the EPA, they've been running behind everything else, and they're now running behind nanotechnology. You know, the train has left the station, and they're trying to catch up.
So how much of an oops percentage might there be? I mean, there's going to be some pretty exotic things that are worked on.
Well, that depends on who you talk to. If you talk to the nanotechnologists who have a lot invested in this, they say, oh, no danger, not proven, don't worry about it.
But they're not the ones to listen to.
Exactly. And so, I mean, the EPA scientists have got some very real concerns. And by the way, I'll just give you an example of just yesterday, for example, in the United Kingdom, the national government there refused to fund a new nanotechnology center, and this was partially due to concerns about understudied health effects of nanoparticles. And they said this clearly. They said, look, before we go running ahead too fast on this stuff, we've really got to start to assess some of the potential medical impacts. And an example of that would be if you get an active nanoparticle sitting next to your DNA or next to your brain matter, it can certainly have some effects that we just don't know about yet because these particles haven't been fully characterized.
I'm glad you brought up gray matter.
Gray goo, right?
Yes, well, sure. It seems to me that in nanotechnology, in the very early stages of nanotechnology, reproduction and sort of consuming anything in your path wouldn't be, you know, the more complicated it'll be 30 or 40 years from now kind of command to give. It would be a relatively easy command. Gray goo, you want to explain that to everybody, please?
Actually, gray goo is a very interesting thing because it's sort of being redefined.
What is? Define it, first
well,
of all.
Well, the classic thing, and by the way, I got an email from one of your listeners about this. Hungry little bugs, Michael Crichton, pray, scared me, what can I do? Well, here's the thing. Gray goo was coined by Eric Drexler, who is known as the father of nanotechnology. And it basically was little self-replicating machines eating every carbon-based thing in existence for energy and replicating forever and ever. That's
bottom line.
Eat to replicate and get energy.
That's right.
Okay.
What
would happen is gray goo would be the result of that process because we would all be consumed by these little robots that were turning everything into gray matter.
So in my mind, Douglas, I visualize a scientist holding a test tube full of
nanobots,
gray goo things in his hand, and oops, dropping it. And then I picture the floor in front of him slowly radiating out, turning gray, and until it's developing first his house, then the city, then the state,
that's the nightmare vision.
Then the world.
Yeah.
Okay.
And if you look at that in nature, for example, you'll see that we get that all the time.
We do?
Yeah, you get all these infestations. You get grasshopper invasions and all kinds of things with these hugely rapid developments of very nasty things.
Yes.
AIDS is another example.
I know.
And they get out of control, and then they collapse on themselves.
They kill so quickly
that
they collapse on them. But that wouldn't be the case with Grey Goo, because Grey Goo, no matter what it was, whether it was dirt, rocks, or anything in its path, would convert it to more Grey Goo, right?
Yeah, but the technologists are arguing that that simply is not feasible.
Why not?
And actually,
in other words, how would it burn out?
Well, Art, the thing is this. First of all, I don't think that that is the short-term risk. And I would like to talk...
Well, maybe not, but it is actually a risk, Douglas, isn't it?
It may be a risk. It may be a risk. But actually, Drexler, who first talked about this, has come out with a very strong calculation and statement, basically saying that this just can't happen with these types of machines.
Does he explain why?
Well, basically, I think he does a very good job of saying, for the same reason that it hasn't happened in nature, because you always get these countervailing forces that come up as a sort of environmental immunity to these things before they get totally out of control. But before they get totally out of control, they can still do a lot of damage.
Mm.
And there is no understating the risk from that type of thing. And in the short term, that risk is translated into another kind of gray goo. And that kind of gray goo is what Ray Kurzweil has been talking about as the main risk, and that is engineered viruses.
Yeah.
Engineered viruses, we think, pose one of the greatest risks long before gray goo ever comes along in the form that you've just been talking about. Because engineered viruses can be done by small numbers of individuals with relatively primitive technologies. And that's where the short-term risk really lies.
All right, but that's shifting it. And I fully understand that what you're saying is correct, that altering of viruses for terrorist reasons is a horrible threat. But you're talking about nanotechnology. And the gray goo thing, it seems to me, I hear you trying to soft play it a little bit, but, you know, even in the early applications, Douglas, of nanotechnology, these are going to be the early instructions, replicate and become this or become that. So it could even happen as an oops thing.
And the place that's going to play out first is with biotechnology. That's why I'm mentioning viruses, because viruses can turn your body into gray goo very quickly if they get out of control and have no resistance to them. I mean, the body can turn to water if it's attacked by a number of very virulent illnesses that are even around today, the Ebola virus, for example.
All right, but look, this is a very strong, very important technology. And so this brings us to where I need to ask you about controls and oversight.
Right.
Surely you're not in favor of no controls and no oversight.
Oh, on the contrary. I think we're going to have to develop a very, very powerful regime that operates quite broadly. And the problem that you run into with that immediately is the Big Brother syndrome.
Yes.
Do we have to have a completely militarized, controlled society in order to prevent this kind of thing from happening?
Well, almost, if it is as strong on the negative side as I suspect it really is, then...
Yeah. And you have a very valid point. No one would ever deny that that is a risk. Now, and the question becomes, how do we cope with that risk? How do we manage that downside risk?